From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The Illinois House of Representatives votes to impeach Governor Rod Blagojevich as Roland Burris testifies that he did not pay to play to get appointed to the U.S. Senate. And Israel and Hamas are rejecting a U.N. call for a ceasefire in Gaza. For a closer look at the week's headlines, we turn to our reporters' roundtable. Joining us today is Jerome Vaughn, the news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan, and Mark Caputo, a state policy and politics reporter for the Miami Herald. Welcome, gentlemen.
It's good to be here.
Good to be with you.
All right. Well, let's start out with Illinois. The House of Representatives voted to impeach Governor Rod Blagojevich. And one of the allegations against the governor is that he tried to sell President-elect Barack Obama's Senate seat to the highest bidder. So, Jerome, does this impeachment vote change the game, both for obviously for the governor, but also with the appointment?
It absolutely raises the stakes as far as how far Governor Blagojevich is willing to go to make his point. I think, he really stunned people right away. There was an expectation once these charges came out that he was going to resign. And I think there aren't a lot of people that expected him to go this far with it. So I think absolutely it's a game changer, and we'll see where he goes from here. But he's been defiant so far in admitting guilt and in wanting to step down.
When you take a look at this, Mark, you have a situation where the former Illinois Attorney General Roland Burris has been appointed by this governor to the Senate seat that Barack Obama once held. But he's been having to restate again and again his case for actually being seated. And he yesterday said he didn't strike any backroom deals with the governor. Is that really the primary issue? Do people think that Burris himself is tainted, or is it more an issue of the process?
Yeah, that's a good question. I must admit, I don't really know what's in people's minds. I'm stuck in our own state legislature right now. We're just doing the boring stuff, or they are, of cutting the budget. But as far as Burris's case is concerned, there certainly doesn't seem to be any evidence currently that he did anything wrong, and he's certainly an interesting kind of jovial character. As my perception is when I see him on television, he seems like a nice guy, but then again, that's what a lot of politicians seem to be. But as far as his role, he appears to have been legally appointed. It's going to be difficult for him difficult for the Senate to deny him the seat. And then as for Blagojevich, aside from being recorded or captured on wiretaps, saying he was going to sell the seat, if he didn't actually sell the seat and they can't prove that, it's going to certainly be difficult to convict him in a court of law. Of course, in a court of a legislature, it's easier to impeach a sitting governor or president. The question is, will they be able to kick him out of office? I would imagine they probably will, because the wiretaps in and of themselves are damning in a civil setting. In a criminal setting, though, I think the bar is higher, the stakes are higher there, and I think Blagojevich is holding on in order for him to have something to negotiate with. If he loses that governor's mansion, he loses one of his only big negotiating tools.
I want to ask you about the session that you mentioned, the session in Florida about the budget cutbacks. And this is a two-week special session. What exactly is on the table?
Well, what's on the table is about $1 billion in spending cuts. There's a total of $2.3 billion budget hole. Our budget has lost about $7.4 billion in 3 years. The state's economy is just tanking. I just heard in the previous newscast about the jobs report. We're the number one job loss state in the nation. We're also now the number one food stamp request state in the nation. People just aren't moving here. The homes that are being built can't be sold. There's a big inventory of empty homes, and that means less tax revenue. We do have a, certainly not on the Blagojevich level, but we do have a House Speaker here who, behind the scenes, steered tens of millions of dollars to a small community college in his district. He did this behind the scenes and also steered and shaped some favorable legislation for them. On the day he was sworn in as House Speaker, he was given a $110,000 a year job. People have bashed this as a quid pro quo. My colleague at the St. Pete Times, Alex Leary, has been writing quite a bit about this. And what's happened since is, under pressure, our House Speaker, Ray Sansom, just resigned his post as the community college, and he's still presiding over the budget cut session. But that's how this session kicked off, with him finally declining to accept the job that a lot of people question. So there is probably a widespread belief, certainly from Illinois to Florida, that there is a pay-to-play culture in politics, and they really wonder sometimes when people get into elected office if they're doing the people's work or the work for themselves. So right now, they're kind of doing the people's work. They're cutting a whole lot of spending, and it's going to be quite a time in Florida. We're probably going to see massive government job layoffs in the regular spring lawmaking session. So it's going to be kind of a tense atmosphere here in Florida, a little less circus-like than it is in Illinois or perhaps even in Washington.
Jerome, from your standpoint, you know, being in Detroit, you have, of course, the well-publicized issue of the former mayor, but you also have this incredible economic barrage of your own in the region, not just in Detroit itself, but in and around Detroit. How's that affecting politics and how it's played?
Wow, it is just about everything right now. I was just going to say, really, in a lot of ways, the only differences between Florida and Michigan right now are the weather. It's warm there, it's cold here. Other than that, we've got huge financial problems in the state of Michigan as well as in Detroit as well. You know, the governor's trying to figure out where to cut in the budget right now. If you look at Detroit is trying to figure out what to do. The deficit is estimated maybe as high as $300 million. The mayor of Detroit is trying to figure out what to cut without impacting police and fire services. But the services for citizens are so minimal already, there isn't necessarily a lot to cut. So it's a real dramatic thing for the mayor to do right now. The city just had its bond rating downgraded to junk status. That means it's going to be harder to borrow money. And in some cases, this downgrade means bondholders can even ask for more money back. That's causing problems. And then the school system as well here in Detroit is the deficit could be as high as $400 million there. There's a public school here in town that things are so bad, they're asking the public to bring paper and toilet paper and pencils for the students. So we are at that same place that many states are, like Florida, like California, where there needs to be some real work done. But I think the politicians don't necessarily have the answers to do that right now.
Do you expect, are there any conversations that are going on about any help of a large scale coming from the federal government for your region? Jerome?
Absolutely. Governor Jennifer Granholm, the Michigan governor, she was almost giddy when President-elect Obama started talking about a stimulus package and a way to get the economy going again. She feels like she's fairly close to him. Michigan, one of the poster children for the terrible economy, that Michigan is going to get some aid from the federal government. How much that's going to be, we don't know, but the governor is hopeful that it will be enough to make a difference.
What about you, Mark, in Florida? I mean, are people expecting the federal government to really step in?
It's not only expecting and hoping. There's a kind of a delicious irony. We have a very Republican-controlled power structure here, a Republican governor, a moderate, though, Charlie Crist, and a rather conservative legislature, both in the House and the Senate. These very conservative lawmakers who belong to the Republican Party, which bash the tax and spend ways of Barack Obama, as well as the Democratic Congress, are virtually begging those Democrats to now pour money into this state. So in the back of the budget bills here, they are actually writing proviso language into the budget saying, if and when federal stimulus money comes in, here's how it will be spent. So they're not only hoping for it, they're almost banking on it.
I want to take a quick look at an international issue that, of course, all of us have been following: Israel and the 14-day war in Gaza, both sides refusing to cease fire, and an aid worker for the UN was killed this week. The organization decided to suspend its aid operations, but is, moving back in, planning to move back in. What do we see ahead in terms of this conflict and how it might affect the priorities of the administration? I mean, obviously, I'm asking you to do a little crystal ball, but is this something that the incoming president is going to have to deal with right away? And will that veer off course from some of the economic priorities? Just quickly, Jerome.
I think it is something that President-elect Obama, when he's president, will have to look at fairly soon. But I don't think anything is going to derail him from the economic situation. It's too deep, it's too grave, and it affects everything else. That's still going to be his priority.
Mark?
Yeah, I would have to agree with him. I mean, let's face it, since 1947, and certainly even before, but when Israel became a state, this has been a problem, and it's going to remain a problem before Obama, during Obama, and after Obama. But the majority of people I speak to and see, and heck, people in my own family, people are laid off, people are without work, people are looking for help, they're on food stamps, Medicaid rolls are growing. And while we watch on television the problems going on in Gaza and Blagojevich, what people really care about is, my God, am I going to be able to make the mortgage payment? Am I going to be able to afford my health care? And these are real critical concerns that we have now, which, in contrast with the giddy times of just 3 years ago, have everyone really focused on this economy.
Jerome, a final thought from you. Obviously, we focus on the African-American experience, and Detroit has a really key place in African-American culture. What are people saying, if anything, about how this crisis of epic proportions is affecting the ability to have a regenerative black culture that can roll with the punches? Are people just getting tired?
I think they are. I mean, I think, here in Detroit, people are hunkered down. They want to get through this. I think they have hope because of the idea of President Obama. They know things are bad, but they have hope that he can make a difference. The other thing with Detroiters is we've been here before, maybe not this problematic in the last however many years since the Depression. But, Detroit, there's this cycle. So people have an expectation things are going to get bad. They're going to get bad. Better, they're going to get bad, they're going to get better. So I think people here are hunkered down, but they do want something to happen soon.
All right. Gentlemen, thanks.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
We were speaking with Jerome Vaughn, news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan, and he joined us from their studios, plus Mark Caputo, a state policy and politics reporter for the Miami Herald. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. When you're faced with losing your home or wondering where the next paycheck is coming from, would you be willing to steal to feed your family? That's a question that some people are asking themselves. As we continue our month-long series on crime, we ask, does the economy impact thefts, burglaries, and other money-motivated misdemeanors? To discuss this, I'm joined by Richard Rosenfeld. He's a professor of criminology at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Welcome.
Thank you.
So historically, what have been the links between crime rates and, the economy, broadly speaking?
The links appear to be very direct, especially when we're talking about the kinds of crimes we are today, property crimes. In every recession back several decades, during the recession, property crime rates have increased, and also, I should say, violent crime rates very often as well. So if we look back to 2001, 2002, that recession, crime rates went up. When we look back to the early 90s or the early 80s recessions, crime rates went up. Mid-70s, crime rates went up. Late 50s, crime rates went up. We can go all the way back to the Great Depression, and then we reach an interesting, I think, paradox, but almost an exception that proves the rule. We did not see substantial crime increases nationwide during the 1930s. And one reason for that seems to be the countercyclical stimulus programs put into place by the Roosevelt administration. The Works Progress Administration, so-called WPA, the Civilian Conservation Corps, put hundreds of thousands into the millions of people back to work, and that seemed to mute crime increases, and that has obvious implications for the incoming Obama administration's proposed stimulus package.
So when you think about what lies ahead, we were just talking with our reporters on our reporters roundtable about some of the regional issues in Florida and in Michigan, two of the states that are, these huge economic engines for the country but are also suffering very deeply right now. How do neighborhoods change, for example, in terms of how crime affects them when there's a downturn like this?
Neighborhoods change in a number of ways. An obvious way is that if people lose their homes, home vacancy rates go up, and vacant homes often are a signal to would-be criminals that may be a place in which one can get away with activity more than in other places. When storefronts go vacant, the same signal is sent. And so neighborhoods, especially neighborhoods already economically marginal, are very vulnerable during economic downturns.
I remember that when Mayor Giuliani was in office in New York, there was a lot of talk about the broken windows theory, which is, you know, what you were talking about, that if you've got a couple broken windows, people know that you've got a neighborhood that's not being taken care of. Has that stood up to the test of scrutiny in terms of a theory for how things develop, that really it pays, it, you know, does it make sense, for example, for communities to band together to try to deal with things like broken windows simply as a way of preserving overall property rates?
Oh, I think it does. There is some controversy over the broken windows notion, but in part the controversy stems from different interpretations of what broken windows might mean. But the general issue of communities banding together to, in a sense, repair those broken windows, which, you know, by extension means to ensure that the lawns are mowed in vacant property, that vacant storefront windows don't get broken, that sort of thing. But more generally, communities banding together to ensure that children who are playing on the streets are kept safe, so enhanced community surveillance, those kinds of activities do indeed seem to reduce crime.
So just tick off a couple of the crimes that you see spike during a time like this, like one or two of the crimes that you think would increase the most in terms of frequency.
Home burglaries and street robberies. In my own research and research others have done, during economic downturns, those crimes tend to go up.
I want to actually turn to someone else who we have with us who can talk about a different perspective on the issue. And we're talking about Reed Hayes. He's director of the Loss Prevention Research Council, and it's looking into crimes against the retail industry. Welcome.
Thank you.
So when you're hearing us discuss the overall picture of crime, you're coming at it from a business perspective. How are you looking at how crime is playing out in these economic times? What are you looking for and looking at?
Well, we are looking at it from the business standpoint, but we're also our criminologist at the University of Florida as well. But so we look at macro and micro components of what's happening. And, you know, anecdotally, the retailers that we work with, and we're working with quite a few of the larger, well-known chains, they're seeing upticks in the amount of people they're catching shoplifting, the amount of people they're catching, their own employees who are stealing. But we've just conducted an experiment that took place from May until November of 08, and we just compiled the data, and it was interesting because during the experiment, and this is 80 stores in Chicago, Atlanta, and Jacksonville, Florida, where we were studying the effects of certain countermeasures that the retailers use on loss and sales in some of Mach 3 and other premium blades. And what we saw was that sales were ticking down continually throughout the experimental time and that losses were ticking upward. So we now have some empirical evidence that during that time period, as the economy overall was weakening, that their sales were weakening and, of course, their losses were going up. But we did find that the effectiveness of some of the countermeasures held true. So we're looking at it from
give me an example, a quick example of what you call countermeasures, one or two of the ways to try to stop theft.
Well, I mean, in this case, we were measuring closed-circuit television domes that are over the aisles. We were looking at public view monitors where they're not only a camera involved, but you can see yourself interact with the camera. And then with these plastic polycarbonate boxes that they can put high-risk merchandise in that make it more difficult to steal.
I'm going to turn back to you for a second, Richard. When you hear about the rise in theft at stores, how does that also affect people? I mean, some people really do say, and we were hoping to hear from someone who has gone in and committed some shoplifting herself. Some people say, look, this is just what I have to do to survive. How does that sense of desperation affect the nature of a community and the sort of standards for how people view ethical behavior?
Well, I think, I think your other guest has an important notion. To the degree that people believe other people are desperate and prepared to engage in behavior they wouldn't under normal circumstances, and get they're getting away with it, that can generate additional crime. But I should say we should be a little bit careful about how we think about an economic downturn influencing people's behavior. It's not simply that someone who loses a job immediately becomes a shoplifter. That may happen, but I don't think it's quite that simple. I think what happens by and large is that as the economy turns down, people, as the economists call it, begin to trade down. They begin to shop in somewhat less expensive retail outlets. So the people who went to Sears now go to Walmart. The people who may have shopped in Walmart are now more likely to shop in the thrift stores run by the Goodwill and Salvation Army or the pawn shops. And we have evidence that Goodwill and Salvation Army thrift stores, and for that matter, Walmart sales, have not plummeted like those of other retail outlets. But then one asks, where do the people who shopped at Walmart or shopped at the thrift stores go? And some of them will go into the so-called street markets where knockoff goods were available and stolen goods were available. And as the demand for stolen goods rises, the incentives for property criminals strengthen and we get more property crime. So it's not simply that desperate people become thieves. It's also that people at the economic margin are more willing to entertain the idea of purchasing stolen goods, and that provides incentives for street criminals.
We're talking about how the economy is affecting crime, and that was Richard Rosenfeld, professor of criminology at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. We're also speaking with Reed Hayes, director of the Loss Prevention Research Council. So when you are listening to Richard, Reed, and the whole, I don't know if trickle down is the right word, but the idea that stolen goods are now going to be ending up on the market. Some people call it boosting when people steal and then sell. If boosting is going up, if other forms of taking markets, goods out of the markets and putting them on the streets are happening, what is a remedy for that?
Well, and we term it organized retail crime, and I would agree really with this broad statement. And we do see that now people are more willing to hit the internet, flea markets, and other sources of, and we call it SCAG, which is stolen, counterfeit, and altered goods, because of that economic effects. But you do see some of the rationalizations are made easier as well, and risk seems to go down. There are fewer employees in stores, and the employees that are there may or may not be as motivated as they were before. But what can you do about organized retail crime? The retailers right now have organized ORC teams that are trying to look for patterns and attack some of the larger networks. They're trying to work with manufacturers and with the wholesalers to try and at least shut down and make it more difficult to move goods that are counterfeit or altered or stolen to the market or be more discriminating. The problem, of course, is the retailers themselves buy, as they call it, off the wire, and they buy goods that are sometimes of unknown origin, not purposefully. So it's a large problem that has to be attacked by working with the manufacturers, the wholesalers, and the retailers, but then also targeting the active boosters and the fences that are in the local markets. And those things are happening. It's just very, very difficult to track, and it's pretty much all demand-driven. And right now, the demand's there, but does tend to grow, I would agree, during these economic times.
And when it comes to taking merchandise, do you think that employees are as likely to take the merchandise as customers? There have been some spectacular cases where people have basically opened up the stores that they work in and even let their friends come in and shop for free. So how do employers respectfully deal with their employees and yet at the same time keep an eye on the merchandise?
Well, a lot of it's about the culture, not just the company culture, but really most importantly the culture at each location. And so, what the retailers try and do there in this case is do a little bit better job of pre-employment screening, find those that are maybe more likely to steal than others because they may set limits. Their ethics are a little more transitory than others. They're situational, in fact. But then try and set the culture. You treat people right. You give them a sense of empowerment and some optimism about the future. But they also have controls who has access to certain areas or merchandise or passwords or codes or the cash. And then also make it a little riskier that they have hotlines where employees can report dishonesty in a confidential way. They have other controls that they can put in their electronic, obviously closed circuit television. If people are stealing from cash registers or not ringing the full price, underringing or sweethearting merchandise out, that those can be tracked and traced through electronic means. So there's a sort of a series of things to do to prevent and detect.
I want to ask about race in the context of what we're talking about, and I want to ask each of you this question, starting with you, Richard. When you have a situation when in many lower-income communities, which are not synonymous with black communities, but there are plenty of black lower-income communities, you walk in, there is plexiglass everywhere. The whole shopping experience has become very walled off and very the whole idea of risk and crime is literally in front of your face. How does that affect, particularly if there's differences in the race between the vendor and the clientele, do we have any sense that that causes hostility in the end? I'm not saying that it's something people shouldn't do, putting up plexiglass, but one thing, one conversation I've had with people is that they feel demeaned by some of the prevention methods that are used. How does that play out, Richard?
I think it may cause hostility and tension in some instances. But, you know, I think we have to put that in the broader context of historical tension in low-income, especially minority communities, between persons customers and retailers, if they're of different groups. You know, absent plexiglass, one still gets some tension between and group-related tension between merchants and customers in low-income communities. But I suspect in some instances that tension is heightened when customers are faced with a walled-off, garrison-like retail establishment.
Reed, do you ever discuss that kind of an issue as you guys look at the research you're doing?
We do, and most of our research now, particularly the last 3 years, has been a little more holistic. We're there because of who we're working with to understand the dynamics from the offender standpoint. We conduct ongoing interviews with shoplifters and fences and other offenders with customers. We do consumer intercepts in stores after a point of sale and so on. And we talk to employees and so forth, and try and collect that systematic evidence about what's going on. We also study CCTV footage to look at dynamics and locations or outside stores. But this does come up. But it comes up with, let's say, minority-owned or operated locations, too, where you might see the garrison effect and so on. It's not exclusive to any particular side, but it can create that problem. But what we find now is that, you know, people sort of are starting to expect and understand that the retailer does need to protect their merchandise. They have to make some kind of profit to stay in business and to operate in those locations where, that are maybe more disadvantaged. And so they may have to take some higher steps. And so, yes, it comes up constantly, and I think that it's a serious issue, or it's an issue that all sides are taking seriously.
Well, on that note, Reed and Richard, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We were speaking with Reed Hayes, director of the Loss Prevention Research Council, and we also heard from Richard Rosenfeld, a professor of criminology at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He was speaking to us from the studios of KMWU in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Yesterday, the doors opened on the annual Consumer Electronics Show in sunny Las Vegas. That's the world's largest gathering of gadget geeks. Even against the backdrop of recession, there's still a frenzy out there in the desert. Our intrepid technology guru, Mario Armstrong, has waded through the cavernous floor of the convention, and he's with us now. Hi, Mario.
Hey, Farai. excuse me. Hey, Farai. How are you?
I'm great.
I called you Farai. Did you hear that?
Yeah, I did. It's all right. I have had a lot of pronunciation. And I know you do how to know how to pronounce the name. But anyway, there's so much going on. And it sounds like you probably have been out partying. You may say it's a cold, but I know the truth secretly.
Party, no.
So what's going on with this new netbook by Vio? I've seen it all over, the tech blogs, and I understand that you've taken a look at it. And tell us what it is, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Sony Vio P is what they're actually calling the model number of this. This is a smaller laptop. This is probably the ideal laptop size. It's larger than a typical BlackBerry, but it's smaller than your 15-inch standard laptop that you currently carry around. This is 1.4 pounds, very, very light. It's only an 8-inch screen. So most laptops usually start off at 10 or 12 inches for the small. So this is very small. It's very thin for, I mean, you could put this in a purse or a backpack, and it's so stylish. But really what's blown, I think, a lot of people away about this particular device is that, A, it's easy to carry. It runs regular Windows operating system software on it, beautiful resolution, and it has a built-in Verizon high-speed, what they call EVDO is a technical term, but basically cellular broadband connection, all built into this one device. I'm just in awe, floored by this particular product.
You have a crush.
I do have a crush. And it's funny because at CES you see a lot of glitz, a lot of clutter, and a lot of things, and you're really trying to get through and sift through it all. And I'm immune to it, so I see a lot of things. So it really has to really move me in order for me to kind of be like really standing behind or really be excited about something.
Yeah, I'm actually interested to check it out myself. But there's so many other things. There's something called Boxee, is that right?
Oh yeah, that's it. Yeah, Boxee, B-O-X-E-E. .tv is their web address. Boxee, what they've done for Rye, one of the big trends that I'm seeing in 2009 CES is the convergence of hardware and software to make it easier for us to watch internet video programming on our home televisions. So I don't know about you, but have you ever tried to connect your computer to your TV so that you could watch, say, YouTube or Hulu.com or any web videos?
I've tried my best to avoid that situation.
And most people do the same. It's kind of complicated. It's too technical. So you're seeing companies now try to really simplify the process of, look, people want to be able to use a regular standard remote. So Boxee offers you a regular standard TV remote, and your television is essentially connected to the internet. And so you use an on-screen menu like you would normally do, like a TV guide, but you might be accessing content that's on the web or over the air from NBC. So it could be from Hulu.com or YouTube, or it could be coming from ABC or CBS.
But how much does something like this cost?
Well, it's a service. What's interesting about this company is that they're brand new. They're in alpha mode right now, so they aren't even in beta just yet. But they're getting a lot of praise and a lot of traffic because of the simplification process that people want to access internet video content easily at home.
So when you say it's in alpha mode, does that mean it's available or it will be soon?
Yeah, so you have to sign up. What that means is if you really want to find out more about it, you have to jump onto their mailing list and hopefully get a access code so that you can get granted access to try out the service.
All right, so that's a little bit of the gadgety side of things, but I want to talk very quickly about a couple big companies. Intel, you spoke with Craig Barrett, the CEO. Anything interesting pop up?
Yeah, and chairman of Intel, man, this guy is phenomenal, Craig Barrett, because, you wonder, when you talk to people that are at such a high level, do they really have a sense of what's going on at the grassroots level? And he really did. I was very impressed with our one-on-one time with him. Intel, as many people know, are responsible for the microprocessors, the things that help our computers, handhelds, and other devices run faster and process faster. So they obviously are talking about how that speed impacts the use of technology. But I thought one thing that was really interesting is how they are taking a strong initiative towards STEM, and that is education, science, technology, engineering, and math. Farai, they've invested and have made the announcement of $120 million going to the funding of programs that will continue to inspire, encourage, and support young minds, middle and high school kids, even in some cases early education, to get them inspired and educated about becoming the next scientists and technologists, because they're concerned about our global competitiveness in technology. So it wasn't all just about glitz and gadgets for them. They certainly had several of that. One real cool note from Intel, they had a car, Farai, that was 4G, which is WiMAX technology, a very advanced, faster than Wi-Fi, but the car was connected to the internet.
It sounds like dangerous news when you're driving. I know that.
Yeah, but I was a passenger, so it was great for me.
All right, we have to let you go, but just one thing, literally a yes or no answer.
Okay.
Will the fact that iTunes is doing away with digital rights management make people buy more music?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we know it all. Mario, thank you.
Thank you, Farai.
Mario Armstrong is News and Notes regular technology contributor. We've been running a series spotlighting some major figures of influence in American culture. We call the series Living Legends. Jazz giant Freddie Hubbard is on our list. Unfortunately, Hubbard passed away just last week before we could bring you the fascinating conversation that he recorded with Tony Cox. Tony's here to tell us a bit more. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Farai. You know, sensitive and precise, iconic and gregarious, competitive, out front and in your face. It sounds like I'm talking about an eccentric athlete, right? But that, in a way, describes the great trumpet of Freddie Hubbard. Now, when I spoke with Hubbard late last year, he was 70 at the time and promoting his final CD, Life Flight. You are hearing the title track from it now. But for I, Hubbard seemed very unsettled by his inability to perform as he once did. So here's that conversation.
A lot of it, I don't have the chops. Because I used to play the head, I used to play the solos and all the shouts and all that. But so one of the guys, David Weiss, he plays trumpet. He says, I'll arrange this stuff. You give me the songs and I'll arrange it so you don't have to play all the way through.
How big a deal is this for you, Freddie Hubbard? Is this sort of a moment of, you know, am I able to do and be what I once was, or am I having to accept that time has put me in a different place? Are you sort of at that stage?
I'm at that because, see, you have to realize that one time or another in your career, and when you get a little older, you can't do the things that you did before. Now, it's been very hard for me to accept that. I always felt like I could blow it and nothing ever happened until this happened. So now it's no matter how hard I practice, it just seems like I can't do things I did. But people tell me, say, man, you don't have to prove nothing. All you have to do is play good enough to get your point across, because I'm not gonna play like I did when you played those earlier records. And it's hard for me to accept that. You know, I don't want these young cats getting off on me, you know.
Let's go back to 1964. Mm-hmm. This is Breaking Point.
I was trying to play like a saxophone.
You did it.
Yeah, but I didn't realize the difficulty
of doing that.
Because you're not supposed to play the trumpet like that. By me getting with these saxophone players, I wanted to play like them. So,
you know, 1964, you were hot. You were on fire. What was it like at that time to be Freddie Hubbard, the star, the headliner?
You know, I was there and I was in competition. Competition with Lee Morgan, Bill Hardeman, Donald Byrd, all these guys were there, and it was a test. I mean, every time you played, you were being watched, and people compared you with Booker Little or Lee Morgan. So that competition kind of kept me going, you know. I mean, it made me strive to play better than I would normally.
What was the high point for you?
The high point, I would say, is when I was with CTI Records.
Creed Taylor.
And he had some ideas for me that really catapulted my career. And he got me a Grammy. I think I won a Grammy before Miles Davis and Dizzy Gillespie. 1972? Long time ago. Not that I thought I didn't deserve it, but not before a lot of the guys who hadn't received one who were great, but.
And that was Red Clay, First Light.
Yeah, that was the, see now, when I, before I did that song, Creed said, man, write a hit. That's, I said, oh, sure, here we go. Because I commercialism never really fazed me. I mean, playing songs that, and licks that you knew everybody would like, I always wanted to be a true jazz artist, you know. Like Creed said, write a hit. So I wrote Red Clay, and all my friends who were jazz musicians, they said, man, you write that square stuff. So it kind of, but that tune has earned me a living.
That's a great tune.
I mean, and it reminded me of my early childhood when I was back in Indianapolis.
They have Red Clay in Indiana?
No, because the guys used to sit on the porch and play their guitars and they would beat their tap their foot. So I kind of adopted that dun 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 dun. I mean, because I mean, my people, my relatives, most of them are from Jackson, Mississippi. So when they migrated to Indianapolis, they kind of brought a lot of that feeling. When he said write a hit, that one song, man. People know me all over the world behind that. Russia, Africa, Japan, all over the world. But people, first thing they say when they see me, Red Clay.
In the course of your career, you've had obviously highs and you've had some lows, and they've been described as personal problems without going into detail. Are we to assume that those problems were substance abuse related?
Well, substance abuse, I wouldn't really say I had a problem with that. I mean, I would say that at one period in the 70s, I started partying. I was in Hollywood Hills, and everybody would come up there. I mean, all kind of movie stars, all kind of football stars, basketball stars, actors. And I had a spot right there on Mulholland overlooking the Bowl, Hollywood Bowl. And the people that I had coming up there, now, the substance abuse, it was around, because a lot of people who would come to see me would bring it. But I would never really say I had a habit or anything like that. I had more of a drinking thing. I started drinking that Jack Daniels and Coca-Cola. And it tore my stomach up, so that was one period I wish I could forget. But, you know, when you're partying and you're young and you're making a little money and you're just having fun and you can overdo it.
You mentioned David Wise. He was quoted as saying something, and I want to know if it really is true that he said it and how you feel about it. He called you, quote, the Barry Bonds of jazz. Did he do that?
I don't think. If he does, I'm going to smack him.
I was like, what? I'm not sure what he meant by
did
that.
Did he say that?
Yeah, well, that's the quote. The context of it was that people were putting off on you or putting responsibility on you for things that other musicians were doing when it came to substance abuse or drugs or problems or whatever sort of thing is. He said everybody wants to sort of put this off on Freddie. He's the Barry Bonds of jazz.
Yeah, well, like a lot of people, I think, are kind of envious of me in that they can't play a lot of stuff that I've played, but yet they don't want to admit it. Now, whatever reason that they dislike me, it has nothing to do with what I played. See, no matter what you say about Charlie Parker, he still created that. Now, maybe because of the substance abuse or whatever, because in the past, I used to wouldn't take any stuff from a lot of people. And I would open my mouth sometimes and say some things to some people that I was believing it was right. But there's a certain way you have to do things and say things to people for them to give you the respect. When it comes time for people, they may say some things about me that maybe I did do some of those things. So that determines their outlook on me.
Thank you. when you have those moments when you are alone at home in your car, wherever, the backyard, and you sit back and you look back over your career, does a smile come to your face?
You know what? At one time, they were talking about he's the greatest drummer player in the world. I mean, I don't believe that because no one person is the greatest drummer player. But when I think I can be put in the same sentence with Miles or Dizzy or Clifford Brown, anywhere in there, you realize how many drummer players are in the world, and to be accepted all over the world as contributing something to this music that maybe nobody else could play or they like it, a smile comes to my face.
That was Tony Cox talking with the late, great Freddie Hubbard. Hubbard died last week.